Hello, and welcome to a special edition of Views of the News. I'm Amy Simons. Normally, following this video open, you would see and hear me, Kathy Kiley, and Ernest Perry on our regular weekly roundtable on media behaviors, but not today. Today, we have something a little bit different. I spent this semester working with six students from the University of Missouri's Honors College. They are students who are interested in current events, politics, tech, and good storytelling. Some of them are journalism majors and some aren't, but what I can tell you is that they are smart, passionate, and have a lot to say. Enough from me, better you hear from them. Here they are.
Thanks for that kind introduction, Amy. Before we get too deep into our conversation, let's start by introducing ourselves. I'm Michael Hark. I'm a freshman studying music and business.
I'm Aiden Maggiore. I'm a freshman studying history.
I'm Elise Folly. I'm a senior studying strategic communication.
I'm Michaela Voris. I am a sophomore studying journalism.
I'm Maggie McCready. I'm a junior also studying strategic communications.
And I'm Audrey Whistle, a freshman currently exploring majors.
It's been more than a year since ChatGPT's initial release. Concerns over the safety and privacy of artificial intelligence continue to be a major source of controversy in America. These concerns led President Biden to issue an executive order at the end of October aiming to protect users against cyber attacks, discrimination, and technical oversight of advanced AI systems. Even with this signing, a study from Pew Research Center found that over half of Americans worry about AI becoming a part of their daily lives. How should journalists better inform the public to understand what AI is and how it will change the workplace?
I think that's such a good question, Michael. As somebody who's hoping to go into the journalism field, I think that we can start by understanding, we need to take a poll and understand what our audience currently understands about AI. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of people see AI as this big, scary monster, and they don't understand, one, how underdeveloped it is, and two, I think that one of the biggest conversations we're having right now is how to use it in education, how to monitor its use in education so that people are actually learning, but also keeping an eye on its development and seeing, you know, where it's going and where it will go.
Especially because I think AI is already integrated in more ways than people realize. And before ChatGPT, it was already present in a lot of ways, and we're even seeing places like Amazon starting to use it in their warehouses. So, yeah, it's a really complex topic, and I'm wondering, do you guys think it's even the role of journalists to explain such a complex topic? Do you think journalists should do that, or should they focus more on the politics and how that's affecting other areas of the media?
I think that as AI is such a new concept, I think it's important to have a lot of people explaining exactly what it is, what this new tool can do, in order to sort of set a baseline for where to discuss from here. I think that AI is a very new tool. I think that it's up to sort of not up to the average American to know about AI and its potential uses and the potential dangers. And I think once we set that baseline, we can go talk about the more pressing issues and other more specific areas. But I think we need to establish that baseline first to sort of understand what exactly we're dealing with here.
And I think that not every journalist is gonna know everything about this topic. It certainly depends on the beat that you get. If you're on the politics beat, you're obviously going to be more concerned about AI with foreign policy or how it's going to impact the way that our government runs, versus if you're on the education beat and it's like, well, how are students using AI to cheat or to learn new skills? And so I think that when we talk about, you know, is it a journalist's place? Well, absolutely, it's a journalist's place to inform and educate. I'm a big proponent of journalism to educate people. I think, though, that there also needs to be, I don't want to say accountability, but people who are designing AI need to be more clear to the general public and not just those niche people who are really into technology and AI. They need to have somewhere that's accessible for people to see, like, hey, this is what we're doing. This is what we're planning to do for this AI. This is what we want this AI to do. I think that that would be also super helpful if people are like, well, I kind of want to hear it from the business themselves, not just the business talking through a journalist.
Totally, yeah. I think that there's a lot of confusion when it comes to the potential of AI versus what it is actually used for. So I think a lot of the confusion with the public stems from all of this potential and not exactly knowing what will amount with AI, where it will will go, what people can do with it, just general lack of knowledge and lack of understanding of the applications of these tools and how they've been in our lives for the past like 10 years. Like you think of social media algorithms, those are similar to AI using the same coding structure. But yeah, I think it's interesting how there are many different applications and it's kind of the job of journalists to help people understand those and how they're shaping our world today.
No, I definitely agree. I think that journalists have such a unique outlet to inform and educate the public, and I think that that's a great spot to teach them about AI because it's so new, it's so developing, and I really do think that that would really benefit not only the journalists learning everything about AI, but also using their knowledge and their wealth of knowledge to teach the public about this really important topic because it is going to become more and more prevalent as we get into society.
Definitely, yeah. And I do absolutely agree that it is a journalist's place to be able to research this and present it to the public, but I think individuals also need to take the initiative because a lot of people just don't research AI if they don't think they have anything to do with it. But just the fact that it's now becoming so prevalent in our everyday lives, I think that that first step has to be taken by the individual.
Right, and I really like what you said about, you know, some individuals, like, we should encourage people to take the initiative because as journalists, we don't want to make our audience feel stupid, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That's one of the biggest, I think, one of the biggest things that people look at journalists and they're like, well, you're so snobby. You're so, like, you know things. Like, why are you over-teaching, I guess? And so to say, like, hey, like, there are resources available that you can do your own research and you can also be informed, and I'm not making you feel stupid or out of touch, you know? Mm-hmm.
As we're talking about sort of what AI is currently being used for, AI does bring greater efficiency in the workplace when used properly. And many companies have been experimenting on cashing in on that by giving three-day weekends, turning the five-day work week into four. School districts across some states, Missouri among them, have been going to four-day weeks too. It's not quite so popular, though, as teachers, students, and parents, and local businesses adapt. Now, do you still think that a four-day work week can still be as productive, or is the fifth day necessary?
As someone who's only taking classes 4 days out of the week, I think a four-day work week in my school week is so beneficial. Having that extra day to just kind of relax and get everything together from your four-day work week has been immensely beneficial. And I really do think adding that extra day of freedom and making sure that you're able to tie up those loose ends from your week and really end your week on a really strong note. I don't have classes on Friday, so it's been really nice to do all my schoolwork. And then once I hit Saturday, I'm like, oh my gosh, it's finally the weekend. So I'm definitely a big proponent of that 4 day work week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we often forget that so much of our humanity is existing outside of the what we can produce and how we spend our time within work or within school or within like these practices that might exchange value in some hand. But you think about all the other ways that you might spend your time with an extra day of like just all of the basic house errands that you might have to do, but also the quality time that you could be spending with people that you care about, the connections you could be building, the community that you could be cultivating with that whole extra day. I think it's an excellent avenue to explore for a lot of people.
I mean, I definitely agree. Like those 4 days, I push myself to the max. I'm really giving my full effort those 4 days, and that fifth day I'm like, okay, I can relax, I can do my laundry. Yeah. Right. It's been so nice. What do you think?
So I have something to say in support, and then I have something to say that maybe we should all be thinking about. So yes, I completely agree that those 4 days, especially as a college student, like, oh my gosh, those 3 days that I have to tie up my loose ends to do my grocery shopping, because it takes me 2 hours to do grocery shopping. Gotta find the lowest prices, man. it's that extra time that I need, and that also I'm gonna be more productive if I'm fully rested and if I'm fully confident that everything is tied up back at home. Mm-hmm. Something that I do want us to think about though, we talked about, you know, greater efficiency in the workplace. I'm thinking about families and parents who have to pay extra for childcare because they still have to work. How do you think that that's going to work for maybe people who have people that they need to take care of in their house? Maybe that's children, maybe that's other family members. How is that going to work for them, do you guys think?
Well, thinking about like one major concern is geared more towards like elementary, middle school education, because you're seeing a lot of people where they suddenly have this extra day that they need to work and their kid isn't in school. Because in a lot of ways, early education kind of functions as a sort of daycare system.
Right.
Like the kids go to school while you work, and then you don't have to like pay for that extra childcare. And so I think a lot of reasons Well, we've seen that a lot of reasons that these districts are moving to this four-day work week is because of economic issues, right, such as teachers' pay, the workload on both teachers and students. And so even though the four-day work week is, like, very efficient, and I agree, like, when I have a four-day work week, it's so awesome. I get so much done in both areas of my life. I think that it would be important to see that restructured in a way of, what if that fifth day is time that is taken at school to maybe work on more social constructs, or to have funding so that kids who, as opposed to just like going to daycare and not doing much, instead get to invest in some sort of topic or interest. Mm-hmm. And so you can cultivate a culture without having to send the kid away and put that extra cost on parents.
I like that. I'd never thought about that before.
Yeah, certainly.
The Supreme Court has a few significant upcoming rulings on the First Amendment and free speech, including on how social media shapes publishing and publishers. A couple standout cases include NetChoice LLC versus Paxton and Moody v. NetChoice LLC. In these cases, the Supreme Court will review the constitutionality of laws from Texas and Florida that aim to regulate social media companies like Facebook and X, formerly known as Twitter, how they can moderate content on their platforms. The Florida law proposes restrictions on social media sites as content curators, such as the prohibiting of removal of political candidates from platforms and clear explanation of content moderation policies. So here's what it boils down to. Can the government compel a publisher to keep something published that they would otherwise take down? For example, a post expressing political opinion containing harmful or threatening language. So what do you guys think of the potential impact of this case?
I think that throughout history, a lot of what the government has done in regards to like the First Amendment, and especially with the media, is they've done a lot of taking down a lot of stuff. Normally when you hear about like the government talking to a media outlet and these big explosion cases, you think of the government striking down something. And now we're kind of in this sort of flipped scenario where the government wants to keep something up.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, this has happened significantly fewer times than the other way around. And I think that like the decision on this case could very well set a precedent for the future that would be sort of difficult to overturn again.
Yes. Most certainly.
I think that the problem when you get into cases like this and you get into the First Amendment, when you look at anything constitutional, it's going to be very hard to put it into our present day context. Obviously, the Founding Fathers were not thinking about, you know, how technology would evolve. So, like, I don't think anybody was on their smartphone during that meeting. But, you know, I think that what we need to think about is, like, okay, when we start regulating social media, which is such a big town hall of sorts for information and for, unfortunately, harmful opinions, will people start taking those cases to court saying, well, I was right in putting this up on social media, and you saying that I have to take it down or that this company has to take it down is regulating my speech and therefore violates the First Amendment? So how do we deal with cases like that, and how do we
but it's touchy because if the company's asking the person to take down, that's not a First Amendment issue.
Exactly.
That's a private company asking, moderating their platform.
Right.
But what's interesting here is that the government is asking publishers to keep content up that they might otherwise take down. So like trolling, for example, if there's like an obnoxious account that's harassing people, the government could be compelled to keep that account up. So I think it opens the doors for a lot of moderation that can just make social media almost unusable. I couldn't imagine a platform that you couldn't scroll through freely with access to the information that you want to see and not access to the hateful comments that aren't helpful in the conversation.
Right.
Yeah, but I think going back to like the content that you want to see within each of these platforms, there is an algorithm that's showing you kind of what they want you to see. So then it gets really hard to moderate, like, where do you kind of draw the line, you know?
Yeah.
If it's each of these private companies, then that's their own business. But when you get into starting to regulate that through like policies and actual laws, that's where it gets tricky.
I think that as a lot of media moves to social medias as opposed to more like classical news sources, just because on social media, I'm talking stuff like your average like post on X or your average TikTok, the like amount of time you have talking about one topic when you're like viewing a post is significantly shorter than if you were to read an article or do your own digging.
Yeah,
so normally when I find myself scrolling through, like if I were to scroll on like any social media for like maybe like 30 seconds, I could find like 5-6 different opinions, mm-hmm. and then just like mm-hmm. the title and then like the post, and they discuss it for maybe 30 seconds and then they move on. And I think as this like rapid content sort of like takes over, especially the content where the algorithm is actively trying to feed you more of the stuff you watch for mm-hmm. longer, right. I think it's gonna become a lot more difficult to sort of have like prolonged intelligent discussions as opposed to I said this on social media and you said that on social media and now we will fight.
Right. Yeah. Certainly.
Yeah. Andrew, yeah. Oh, no, go ahead.
The speed of social media and the technology that we're using definitely boils down any nuance that might have been possessed in like traditional reporting, if you can argue there is. But yeah, so I think what you were saying with social media making it so quick is really taking out a lot of the critical thinking and a lot of the nuance that people need to consider with big political ideas.
Certainly. Absolutely. On the point of the Supreme Court, I feel like the Supreme Court has been at the center of the news cycle lately, especially since coming out with its new code of ethics. The Constitution and Congress already technically have checks and balances on the Supreme Court, but because of new revelations about certain judges accepting gifts and speaking at political party events, the question becomes, who will enforce this code? Are journalists going to be the one enforcing it?
This is really interesting, one thing that I always thought was crazy is the fact that judges aren't supposed to be affiliated with a political party. That's something I didn't realize.
But it makes sense, though, when you think about it, right? Because
you don't
want that partiality. Yes.
That's, like, the whole design of it.
Right.
In
yes.
And cases, everything like that, mm-hmm. yeah.
And I think it's a good design. And I feel like this conversation gets a little bit, it sounds kind of similar to what you see with Congress and lobbying. A lot of people saying, like, that's kind of odd. Why can officials accept gifts from companies? Mm-hmm. And if that's happening with judges and how people associate, like, appointed judges with a certain president and that having an effect on some of their rulings and if they lean left or right.
Right.
How that works. Mm-hmm. But as for the enforcing, I feel like you would have to put something, you have to put something in writing. You always have to put something yes. in writing, and you're
exactly.
going to have to find some way that Congress can officially say, hey, yes, like these judges have been accepting things from these people and have obviously been showing a bit of partiality towards this party. Maybe on certain cases for the next however long of a term, they like don't have a vote or should abstain mm-hmm. from voting.
Right, and I think the issue with the Supreme Court is that their term is for life, so mm-hmm. they're there for a very long time. And then when we talk about, you know, journalists enforcing it, journalists are already supposed to be the watchdogs who are saying, hey,
yes.
this isn't right, this doesn't
yes.
line up.
Yep.
And while that's great and all, you also get that, you also get the issue of saying, like, okay, well, what technically, like, who is,
what's
are
the practicality,
right? And are mm-hmm. are journalists going to be the judge, jury, and executioner for these judges of, like, okay, people know this information, now what are they going to do? Are they going to have those judges taken down? Are they going to be told, like, hey, you have to sit out on this issue, like, mm-hmm. what's the punishment, essentially, if they don't follow this new code of ethics?
I think that journalists have, like what you said, they have power to be a watchdog, but I think that that's sort of where their power, unfortunately, sort of ends. Like, mm-hmm. a watchdog can bark, and it can bark and it'll alert you of the trouble, but it's not going to write anything down. In order to, like, check the government, our government system is constructed in such a way where if you want to challenge the government, you have to get the government to challenge itself. Mm-hmm. And as we've talked with, like, this code of ethics and how judges are supposed to be unpartisan, but are also served for life, I feel like that in order to check one of the most powerful positions in the country, you're going to need something like the legislative or the executive branch to sort of step in and put their foot down on what they want the Supreme Court to follow. So I guess all in all, I guess the journalists are sort of there to kind of like call attention and to sort of like get like public attention to be like, hey, Congress, can we do something about this, please?
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
What a dream.
Yes. I like what you said, Aiden, about the journalists and the public kind of being in cahoots with each other of like the journalists are going to say, hey, public, do something, and the public has to do something.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think journalists can gauge public input and thought on this decision? Because obviously we have social media, right? But we just got done talking about how sometimes social media either puts opinions on one side or the other, or there's not much varying thought. How do you guys think that journalists can gauge that public input accurately?
I think the easiest way would just be to actively listen and engage
yeah,
with your audience.
Mm-hmm.
View what's going, take a look at what's going on,
social
and try and engage.
Like reviews, making sure you're really up to date with those who are reading your story.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Continuing our ethic conversation, speaking of ethics, I want to talk about ethics in sports reporting. Amazon Prime Video and sports reporter anchor Carissa Thompson appeared on Barstool's podcast, Pardon My Take, saying that she would fabricate some of her reports for the broadcast. And she said this wasn't the one-time thing she'd do it when coaches wouldn't come out for halftime or was too late to get a quote for the report. Her defense? Saying that no coach would be mad at her for saying, hey, we need to stop hurting ourselves. What do you guys think about this? And is it ethical in sports reporting?
So, as someone who's not a journalist, when I got the Canvas announcement to say, like, hey, look at this, my first thought was, like, wait a minute. Isn't that, like, the opposite of what the journalist should be doing? Right. Like, shouldn't the journalist be, like, reporting the truth and, like, calling for public opinion, not just, like, making stuff up because they feel like it and they just need a story? I'm like, even if someone doesn't, like, follow, like, as, like, a journalism major.
Right. Okay, listen. I don't want to defend her at all because, oh, that makes my blood boil. It's so upsetting to see journalists just sloppy reporting. That's all that is. Mm-hmm. It's irresponsible, too. I think that when we think about journalists and the news cycle, though, I do want to say that it's a very fast pace, like you are constantly going. And so I don't want to defend her, but I do think that we should take a look at how fast the news cycle moves, especially with sports.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Like, why didn't she have enough time to get a quote? Why was it too late for her to do such things? Is it just A, that she's a sloppy reporter, or B, because she genuinely didn't have enough time, and should we examine how quickly the news cycle moves?
Mm-hmm. I definitely think the question boils down to, is she going to get in trouble, or versus is it ethical? I think that's a real question here. A decade ago, we'd never be talking about this, but the times are changing, and another professional sports team is moving to Las Vegas. The latest, the Oakland A's will be moving east in 2028, join the Raiders of the NFL and the Golden Knights hockey team. What do you guys think makes Las Vegas super attractive for these professional sports teams?
I think they just have a draw. Like, it's such a big city that draws so many tourists. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they already, like, with the Raiders and having the Golden Knights, they already have a big sports fan base there. So I think, especially for the Athletics, they haven't been the best baseball team in the last couple of years, so I think just having that draw and, you know, getting to fill stadiums is really their main goal.
I think a lot of tourists are coming. Sports betting's legal, so it's definitely
a huge
market for those athletic teams. I really do think there's a lot of money there, and those teams that are kind of in a dip, like you saying with the A's, mm-hmm. they're searching and scrambling for anything to get revenue up, and I really think that sports betting possibly in Las Vegas would be a really good solution for them.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. sometimes it's just a change of scene, like certainly. When they change the Milk logo, right. They could just so that people would start talking about it. Yeah. Being able to say, we're in Las Vegas now. Everyone goes, I forgot about the A's. You're in Las Vegas now. That's crazy. And that, of course, is just going to get a lot more of the general public, especially people that kind of just are like, hey, you know, I should get back into that. Or maybe I have to visit them one last time before they go.
Yeah.
So part of that can just be rotation, and a change of scene can always be good for business, getting in new markets.
And it's not just traditional American sports that are making their way to Las Vegas this year. The weekend before Thanksgiving, 1.3 million people converged on the city for its first ever Formula One race. One big win for Vegas, the revenue the race brought in, about $1.2 billion dollars. But the locals weren't too excited about it because of how much of the city had to be shut down. So with Las Vegas' locals' reaction to the Formula One race and the city already hosting about to be three professional major league teams, how do you think this is going to have an impact on the residents or on tourism in general?
Well, I think tourism is always going to keep going, right? It's Las Vegas, the city of light. Everybody wants to go to Las Vegas. And so I don't think that it's going to do anything to harm tourism. However, I think that local businesses and things like that and local residents mm-hmm. who had been launching those complaints, maybe they will boycott those events. Right. I think that I think the city government will continue to want to have those one-off events, but I'm sure that there will be, the citizens will make them rethink their decision, or at least have them work more closely with residents and local mm-hmm. businesses.
I agree. Shutting down the entire city was incredibly extreme.
Right.
Yeah.
If I were a Las Vegas resident, I'd be like, how do I get to work?
Exactly. 3 days.
In 3 days.
Exactly.
So then you have to uproot your entire life, your job, your way to work, your everything, just so that you can have this Formula One race. Is it really worth it? I don't really know, but that's a great question, definitely.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And we have spent so much time this semester talking about this, we're not going to pass up the chance to bring it into our episode of Views of the News. trailer. I mean, who isn't talking about Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce? They made headlines wherever they go. Reports are flying that they could be moving in together and that he might even put a ring on it. So what makes the relationship news, and why do people still care? Xavier University's Leslie Rasmussen says Taylor Swift just has that Midas touch. Anything she's touching has to turn to gold right now. So who would have guessed how much buzz trailer would bring in and how long it would last? But she also was just named Times Person of the Year for 2023. Yes! So the buzz is definitely not dying down anytime soon. But especially with their like relationship, why do people still care? Like, are people still going to be focused on them in 6 months, in a year from now?
I think part of it is just like both of these celebrities have kind of like this cult fan base. Like, you know, people that are like, I love football.
Yeah. And then, I love Taylor Swift.
And Taylor Swift fans, yes. That's Swifty. It's like a word now, like in the dictionary. Yep. And so I think it's just incredible. Like, those are two very American things that Americans all just love to talk about. And the fact that like those two worlds collided just brought so many people together.
It's like a star-crossed lover situation. Yeah. It's like the football player and the singer are coming together. And I personally do not think the hype is going to shut down anytime. Who they're gonna move in together, possibly, allegedly. And I mean, like, his football season still continue ramping up, possibly towards a Super Bowl. She's going on tour again. Like, there's so many things that these two people are going through that I think will keep them relevant, keep their relationship relevant. And also the Times Person of the Year, that is a huge achievement for person. Right. And I really do think that. I think we spent so much time in this class talking about trailer. I don't think that the hype is gonna die anytime soon.
Right. Yeah. And Taylor Swift isn't just a national icon, she's also a global icon. Right. She's been touring all over the world. So, like, even if somebody, you know, in England or Africa decides to Google her name, she's going to pop up with Travis Kelce. So,
I think the note that you made, Michael, about how it being kind of distinctly American and energies when you have the NFL football player and this, like, country rock star that we've all kind of grown up with, especially people of our age and older, just such an iconic couple that it just makes sense for it to be so astounding in the media sphere and just on everybody's mind. I think it's just the energies meshed well.
I mean, you can't go a day without looking on your phone and be like, oh, trailer and trailer and trailer, new advancements every single day.
Yeah, we had Spotify Wrapped come out. Oh, she was the number one artist, and then now she's Person of the Year. I feel like there's just headline after headline.
I think the story just writes itself. I mean, you have like two like colossal superstars with so much like stuff to talk about in their own right, and now they're both part of the same world. And like you talk about, we've taken the football people and the Taylor Swift people sort of slammed them into each other to see what would happen. It's like we're like crazed scientists just watching this unfold.
I mean, the question here is, who put who on the map? Did Taylor put Travis on the map? Did Travis put Taylor on the map?
I have my own opinions, but I want to hear.
People
were like, Taylor.
Who?
Taylor.
Yeah. She definitely did. And really, I think both of them, they just kind of play off each other. It's an awesome story. I don't think it's going anywhere anytime soon, but that's it for us, Amy. Back to you.
Aren't they great? I hope that you enjoyed their conversation as much as I did. Before we go today, I'd like to share a couple of special thank yous to Maggie Turner and JJ Meeser, who are our floor directors today, and to RJI's Travis McMillan, who helped me in both directing and producing today's show. Thanks for spending the last half hour with us. We look forward to joining you again soon for another edition of Views of the News.